A Radio 191 FM podcast.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. This is R1 News here on Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi 91 FM. Ko Quinton Tianei, and I'll be taking you through the news from now until 12 o'clock. Coming up on the show I tēnei rā, we have Lily with the bulletin and weather. Following that, I'll be speaking to Sean Tiao, International Representative at the Otago University Students Association, about the recent government announcement that international students will be allowed back into New Zealand from the end of July. Following that, we'll be speaking to Dr. Olivier Dutel, a cryptocurrency expert in the Department of Media, Film and Communication, about the cryptocurrency crash that decimated the crypto market last week. And finally, as always, we have a kōrero with Critic Te Arohi editor Fox Mayer about the music issue of Critic Te Arohi this week. Right now, here is Lily with the bulletin and weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM news headlines.
Kia ora koutou, ko Lily aho. Health services across New Zealand will be reduced today as 10,000 healthcare workers strike together. Workers from 70 different professions are marching for increased pay as organised for the Public Service Association. District health boards have been negotiating with the association for over 18 months on allied healthcare worker pay. New Zealand Oral Health Association executive member Sam Carrington said that graduates often favour the private sector as starting wages in the public sector were often just over 80 cents above minimum wage. Kiriana Brooking, a Hawke's Bay DHB spokesperson, said that the lack of healthcare workers would be felt across the country today, saying that a number of appointments had been rescheduled and some services reduced to their life-preserving minimum. The government will reveal its emissions reduction plan today at midday. It follows the announcement of three emission budgets last week, which detailed the caps on greenhouse gases that New Zealand can emit across the next 15 years. Grant Robertson will reveal the plan to the media in place of Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who is currently recovering from COVID-19. Climate Change Minister James Shaw said that tackling climate change is a generational challenge that requires consistency across governments. The budgets have been billed as the first binding domestic framework for New Zealand and a guide to curbing emissions no matter which government is in power. Edinburgh Realty has been forced to retract a letter demanding Otago students to decide their renting plans for next year by the end of this month, after an investigation first done by R1 News' Quinton Jane and now picked up by the Otago Daily Times. Several students had raised concerns to OUSA after a letter had been sent out about Edinburgh Realty asking students to indicate whether they would re-sign their flats by May 2nd. The letter also said if a new lease was not arranged, the flats would be advertised by June 7th. Students on a 12-month lease are only legally required to inform landlords of their plans on December 3rd, according to the Residential Tenancies Act. A follow-up email was sent out on April 28th, amending the initial letter by saying the company would begin prepping properties for advertising, but listings would only be made public after confirmation was received on the tenant's decision to continue their tenancy or not. OUSA Student Support Manager Sage Burke said his message for students and landlords was the same: be professional and aware of your rights and responsibilities. And now, the weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM weather.
It is currently 9 degrees in Dunedin this morning. It's set to be a sunny day with a high of 15 and a low of 4. Tomorrow we'll see showers periodically throughout the day with a high of 13 and a low of 8.
That was Lily with the bulletin and weather. Coming up on the show next, we speak to OUSA International Representative Sean Tiao about the return of international students to Aotearoa. Then after that, we speak to cryptocurrency expert Dr. Olivier Dutel about the ongoing cryptocurrency market crash. Right now, here is Human Susan with Double Dutch on R1 News.
Come on. bad guy. Have I hurt your pride? We could turn around, try to calm it down, but I know us too well. It's about to go off. Infatuated, I'm hurting for you. Taking a breath, but I'm flowing over. Baby, it's not malicious, I just wanna write it out. Why is it so delicious when you're stomping on my ground? Take it up.
Listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. That was Miyake with Infatuated, and before that was Human Susan with Double Dutch. Last week, the government announced that Aotearoa New Zealand's borders would be completely reopening to the world, months earlier than initially planned. From July 31st, the borders to New Zealand will behave as if there is no longer a pandemic, with cruise ships welcome into New Zealand waters and international students rejoining our campus. Minister for Education Chris Hipkins acknowledged the strain that the border closure had placed on the multi-billion dollar international education industry, and the minister will be travelling to the United States, Brazil and Chile later in the year to promote New Zealand as a location for international exchange students. International students will, however, face a higher barrier to study in Aotearoa than they did previously, with the government requiring prospective tertiary students to display access to a minimum of $20,000 per year to cover their living expenses. This is $5,000 higher than the previous threshold. The July 31st date comes 3 weeks after the University of Otago resumes teaching for the Semester 2 period. University of Otago Director International Jason Cushion said that the announcement dates were very good news and would give international students currently offshore a greater degree of confidence to make plans to return to study at Otago on campus. Cushion told R1 News that the university is currently working through the implications of the announcement to assess international students' abilities to return to Otago University for Semester 2. This will depend on a student's course of study, when they'll actually be able to make it to campus, and if they are already studying online through the university. For students who are able to return, the university has limited accommodation options available, but are investigating other options, However, Cushion isn't expecting a large increase in international student numbers until next year, when international students will be able to apply for university-managed accommodation in the same way that domestic students do. I'm joined in the studio now by Sean Teo, International Student Representative for the Otago University Students Association, to talk about the recent government announcement. Morena Sean, it's great to have you in the studio.
Kia ora koutou katoa, thanks for having me here, and warm international greetings.
Oh, thank you. Sean, what is your reaction to the announcement that international students will be allowed in earlier than previously expected?
It's really, really welcome news for our end, because we haven't had new faces in a while, and our community has taken quite a hit because of that. So for the past 2 years, we've just been lacking the numbers and, you know, the new gens that we've been waiting to see every year. But some of our cultural clubs have been struggling because of that. So that's one big factor as to why, you know, they're really struggling this year in particular. But it's definitely one situation that's constantly evolving. So we're going to have to keep an eye on it in order to see how we can better support those students and those clubs. But we're definitely happy. You know, we're really happy to hear about that. It's an important part of our community. I mean, you kind of have an international community without the international students.
Exactly. So,
yeah, it's been something that we've been wondering for quite some time now. And, you know, we contribute so much to the diversity to these spaces. And it's always one of the highlights of my experience here at Otago itself, where, you know, there's just so many different people on one campus. Like Otago in particular, unlike the other unis, noticing the other unis there, has this sort of vibe, I guess, that's very easy to like bring these communities together in a much more tight-knit fashion. So I'm just hoping that with the border announcement, that we'll be able to get that back up and rolling again at full force. In terms of why, like, how this affects cultural clubs as well. Well, some of my friends have also been doing their roles for quite some time, their leadership positions in cultural clubs. So that's great and all, but, you know, we love our work, but we won't be studying forever. And that's, you know, the reality of the situation. So having a newer generation of students take up the mantle would be awesome. My last notes on that is really, well, as much as we are very excited for this news, we are also anxious. We want to support these students as best as we can, since we're students ourselves. But we're going to have to tread lightly and see how we can go about supporting these students.
Excellent. And so do you think that for the international students that are able to come over in this semester coming, that it could be hard for them to find accommodation since the uni flats are already tenanted?
Yes, very much. I definitely think it's a real issue that we've been trying to think about, but it's one of those new issues that, you know, border recovery is something that's new to everyone. And in particular, especially if you're working in the international student space, it's one of those things where you really have to get your head around it. Otherwise, we won't be able to support the students in our capacities that we're capable of. But it's definitely a tricky one for sure. Yeah, one of the few can of worms that we've had to deal with this year. Usually first years would situate themselves in like residential colleges, for example. But even among first years, not everyone wants to do that for various reasons. So they might go for uni flats or go straight to flatting. But flatting has always been tricky. So not just for the international community, but even for our students domestically as well, as I'm sure everyone will know. So it's an ongoing issue. Our residential officer from OISA, which is the Otago International Students Association, for those who don't know, and the rest of our team want to provide better resources for that and support our incoming students as well. As a team with students who have had experience living in Dunedin for quite some time, and, you know, we're not from Dunedin, we know the local renting market better, and we want to share what's that like with that combined experience, so we can have the incoming students, we can help the incoming students with, like, a better sense of what it's like to flat at Dunedin and what you need to do to get things going. But it's particularly tricky since they are definitely away from doing physical viewings and stuff. Like, that's an important part, because usually the transition is residential college or uni flat, and then you go into normal flatting, and then you do your own like research. The disadvantage that they have is they're not here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've probably like lived at their households for quite some time now, so it's still going to be quite the daunting like shift and transition back into a proper uni experience per se, right? So we're just currently trying to get some student feedback and see how we can go about being able to provide more informative resources that will be able to help these students.
Indeed. And so this date that has been announced, it's 3 weeks after the beginning of semester two. Do you think that this will be a problem for international students hoping to start in semester two?
Yes. You'll find that most of these questions you'll ask me today probably has a yes answer to. if it's a problem, yes it is.
Yeah.
So that's kept me busy this year. I love the work, and it's great problem-solving experience, I guess. But yes, in particular about the 3 weeks, after semester two starts. As you can tell with this whole situation, most of these problems are tricky to resolve. So not only do you have to... do you have the problem of whether the visas will be approved in time, that is, which has been an ongoing thing within our community. You also have the fact that these students will miss out on key events that might help them get assimilated into the community. So like when I came during the second semester, I was late, and then I missed out on all the like welcoming like events, for example. But I'll get into that in a bit. So sure, they've had experience doing their studies online, which is why I think it might not affect their academics to the extent that we believe, since they've already done it for 2.5 years mm-hmm. plus maybe, or even longer. But it's still a definite concern of mine, because these students have done it for 2.5 years, and I'm sure we all would dread having to have like 2.5 years of constant online learning. So that's basically the situation. And I know everyone empathizes on the whole online learning situation. So we hope that they'll be able to get their visas processed for as soon as possible. But that's a whole nother like discourse, because it involves immigration and all the processing issues, and how they're really struggling with like the border recovery too, despite them being the ones to facilitate that. Mm-hmm. So it's all about like really ensuring that the relationship between uni, government, and the students stays quite healthy in that regard. In terms of the students that are coming back, I believe you talked about Jason Cushion saying yes. That most of the increase in numbers, the massive ones, would probably be for next year. I also think that's the case mm-hmm. as well. Some students who will be doing online studies and considering it, I'm sure they'll have the same thoughts of, I'm just going to be doing online study anyways for like one more semester, and then I can like take some time to like prepare to go to New Zealand when things like settle down a bit and the border recovery is in like full force. So I'm thinking that's probably what some of the students might be thinking overseas. And in terms of coming during the second semester, it's this real awkward period where I identify as a second semmer, I guess, or that's a label for us, like students who start in the second semester. And the whole visa uncertainty issue is very, very much like relatable, because I remember before coming to university, I only had 1 day left for my visa to get approved. And on that very last day, my visa got approved. And I had the chance to either cancel my flights in 1 day or get ready to go in 1 day. So it was quite
stressful.
Stressful. Yeah, exactly. And, it's coupled with the stress of not knowing whether or not you'll be there for quite some time. So I came late, like I said, and I missed out on quite a few activities. So that's one concern of mine if students do decide to come here. So hoping to do some sort of orientation seminar or like some events that might help them settle into Dunedin since it's their first time, much easier as well.
And so you've started alluding to my next question then, which is what accommodations would you like to see made for international students who are hoping or who do make it over next semester?
Yeah, so I'm dreaming here, but I wish there was a residential college dedicated to international students. There used to be a college for postgraduate students, and you know, the students that I have spoken to said it was a great place to like meet the rest of the community and people of like the same situation. But yeah, that's definitely a dream. It's quite idealistic of me. But if we're talking realistically, we'd also like UniFlats, I guess, to be a bit more accommodating, since some prefer to break into the community with UniFlats before going on to like normal sort of flatting situations. But it's definitely an ongoing discourse with the whole like situation with UniFlats. Like, we really hope that they're accommodating to students who might be able to come in. We just hope that they've reserved like a few spaces for these students. If we can get like numbers going on, like how many students will like confirm their decision to return, then that would be great. But as you can tell, this is an issue that doesn't just link to the university, it links to the whole government and how fast they can process the visas, hopefully, fingers crossed. Yeah, something like doing virtual viewings would be awesome for these students who can't be here physically. They definitely deserve to have a place to live in. My residential officer at the moment is looking for solutions to try and resolve this. So, but it's definitely an issue that was brought up even just in the past 2 weeks, and we're currently still brainstorming like ideas on how we can better let these students know what accommodation options are available. Yeah, but it's going to be a real struggle, that's for sure.
Mm. And so final question for you before we wrap up here is, with international students coming back to New Zealand, what are some changes that you'd like to see made at a university and a national level to improve accessibility and the experience for international students?
I think that's a really good question to ask. Obviously, the relationship with university is also sometimes linked to government, especially on the international student community front, right? There's always this case of immigration, like, not doing this, and it's causing frustration for students. And, excuse me, and the universities trying to make up for this and ensure that the student well-being is being taken care of. But at the same time, it's always like back and forth. It's almost like playing ping pong in that regard. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the ball's in your side and you just have to try and hit it back. But yeah, at a university level, I want all our international students enrolled here to have access to that key information about their return, or I guess their welcome into New Zealand, as soon as possible. It's imperative that it's a must, you know. I knew how anxiety-inducing it can be, and uni should definitely be delegating or a considerable amount of resources to making that happen, because it's that whole flow of communication concept that we want to ensure the students get that information as soon as possible, because it's quite the uncertain situation, and the only way to deal with that is to give some certainties, to let them know what to expect, instead of letting them, you know, second guess things and, you know, dwell into their anxieties. That's something we don't want to happen. So that's what I think the university should do. So the international office already has been working incredibly hard to do just that, but we should definitely show these students that we truly are looking out for them by being more proactive. So this year me and my team work very, very closely with the international office, so we'll be able to provide much more direct and much more fast and efficient like feedback for the international office to consider. So we'll be able to like tap a few shoulders and make sure that they're doing their job, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the uni side of things. I think they're more than capable of handling it, especially with the collaboration that we've had this year. The staff and student relationship this year between the international office and OISA is much stronger than ever. And we are hoping to ensure that this collaboration works to the benefit of all these students as much as possible. At the end of the day, it's about quelling that uncertainty and providing that certainty, right? At a national level, It mainly focuses on the whole visa issue that I've talked about in the past 40 minutes. Well, we know that it's a huge can of worms, but as students and some of us, as students, some of us are still learning how to adult, and it can be pretty daunting. So I can imagine that that whole issue, the whole visa process, will be extra stressful this time around because it's a whole border recovery situation instead of the normal situations. We're working towards getting back to that sort of normalcy, but as some have mentioned in the community, it's not going to be like that for a long time. But we are still ecstatic at the news. It's such a bittersweet feeling. In fact, we hope immigration, lack of a better term, can sort their shit up. we truly hope so. It's just to ensure the whole smooth processing of visas is well prioritized for our international students so that they can have less stress, and have less worries about the whole situation. Prioritizing student visas should definitely be a top one. And that's not, discounting or invalidating the other visa applicants at all either. But in light of the circumstances of being a student, having to study and being on a time stress schedule, and it's labs are going to be starting 2 weeks later, and they're going to have missed out on a few labs. The whole practical part of the uni experience is really essential, I believe, and that's why having the students on campus would be necessary for that, obviously because of the physical limitations. We are studying on those real-time circumstances, basically, and it will definitely benefit student well-being and their academics. It will transition much earlier with as less stress as possible. Final notes on that would be, the government should communicate better with the uni more. The lack of communication, or I guess mail communication, I'm not sure if that's the word, is such a serious issue, and that's already caused quite a few issues already with the whole visa processing on campus being removed for a different system. But this is the year they decide we're not going to put in the system straight away, we're just going to take it away. So we're left with quite a bit of a struggle right there. Yep.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Sean. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
That was Sean Theo talking about the arrival of international students back to the University of Otago. Coming up right now, we have Meg Theron with Stargazing on R1 News.
Rooftops, seeing the world when the moon stops. Trying to get higher when the motion comes with the focus. Leave the lights off but they don't notice. Rooftop, how did I get up here? One step down but I don't wanna give up yet. 10 stories, gotta show and tell. I may as well. Had a plan but then I went and fell. 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 Left, right, where I started, only putting up these walls. Things that I would feel, but I feel I can never say. Moving out of focus, eventually we get away into our own minds. Run away from the feeling we don't wanna find. Try to change, but my truth is kinda bona fide. Hard to notice when you're feeling like you're out of line.
You're listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. Last week saw cryptocurrency markets plummet, with some news outlets reporting over $1 trillion in cryptocurrency valuation disappearing in the face of a week. Cryptocurrency Luna Coin plunged close to $0, down from a high of $100 after its sister stablecoin lost its US dollar peg, rendering it worthless. Stablecoins are cryptocurrencies whose valuation is tied to real currency with the intention of increasing their stability and thus their usability. This crash has once again raised questions about cryptocurrency, both its viability as a currency generally, an investment, and its Ponzi scheme-like nature. We're joined in the studio now by Dr. Olivier Dutel, a lecturer in the Department of Media, Film and Communications, who has a specialty in cryptocurrency. Morena, Olivier.
Morena, Quentin, thanks so much for having me, man.
Thank you for coming on. Can you give us a bit of a rundown about the crypto crash that's been going on?
Well, so, like, I mean, you described stablecoins pretty well there, and that's really the key thing, is that because crypto does not function like currency, it needs these sort of stable coins that have the inherent, in theory, inherent values of a currency, i.e. they can hold their price. So that, because I mean, one of the funny things about this crazy crash is the market never stops, right? Until you break one of the exchanges, and then they just halt all trading or freeze people's accounts. But you need these stable coins in order to treat crypto as something, even or to get your money out of it, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the rise of stable coins have been really significant since the 2017 surge. And they're supposed to be backed by various stable coins have different levels of how they assemble their sort of reserves, whether that's sort of like a basket of cryptos or Tether, which at for a time claimed to be actually backed by hard fiat currency. The Luna Terra deal was basically to incentivize holders of either coin to shift their holdings algorithmically on the basis of fluctuations, and that would help keep the peg, i.e. keep one UST, that's Terra, equivalent to one US dollar. And of course, the very fact that they need to sort of like still deal in dollar terms tell you something about the failings. But of course, nothing tells you more about the failings than when Terra essentially goes down 99.9% and is now an absolute, you know, there's nothing there. And, you know, the thing with stable coins is they can only sort of sustain this ideal of being approximating a dollar, in so much as these markets, if you can call them markets, they're very brittle and they have no kind of consumer protections. But if the sort of general communities in and around the exchanges, these markets are believe in the myth, essentially. And as soon as that's gone, you know, you can see dramatic implosions like the one we did last week. And of course, the question going forward is, are we going to see more of that? I am strongly in the yes camp, but we can talk about reasons why.
And so, yeah, you've kind of led to my next question, was what is the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak?
Well, so a lot of the, you know, Bitcoin maxis and true believers will say something like, oh, you know, maybe it was, you know, an investment firm like BlackRock or some nefarious agent got in on this and, you know, played a kind of a short game, if you will, to implode the currency and to make something like $1 billion on the implosion of the currency. Maybe that's true, but again, we're talking about extremely brittle currencies or securities or however you want to call it, when the whole claim of crypto is this is strong, encrypted, algorithmic laws of finance. Like, this is the whole value proposition is that in the encryption blockchain process, that they have discovered something so powerful that it can't be hacked, and we know that's not true, and it can't be stopped. It's sort of like the algorithmic force of free markets and also the technology that will build the metaverse and blah, blah, blah. And now we know that's not true. This is a kind of an irony in that, well, if they were broken by BlackRock or some hedge funds acting in this space, I mean, normally when traditional financial actors are in this space, they parade this as a huge proof of their success. But again, we know that All these claims about strength of encryption and code is law and all this kind of stuff, whenever it gets hacked, I'm like, sorry, you don't get to complain about that because your whole thing was that this is, can't happen. And so it has happened. But then, so that was the straw, if you will. But really, at a fundamental level, there is no value proposition in crypto, right? Like, you know, let's say people like to compare it to gold as a hedge against inflation. And we know that the fluctuations of the crypto market mean that that's not true. But gold is something you can use in, it's in your computers or it's in tech, it's in jewelry. It has some cultural uses that allows you to just sort of like sit it out when the market for gold is turbulent. Crypto has none of that. Unless you believe we're going to live in some Ready Player One metaverse, and that's going to be the coin of the realm. That's a hell that I would never want to live in, and I'll attack all the hard drives and computers on Earth to prevent something like that from happening. But it won't happen, thankfully. And then there's the stable coins that themselves are garbage. They're flaming hot garbage. Like Tether. I'll stop there, but yeah. I mean, there's nothing fundamentally inherent. They're not backed by hard reserves as they claim to be. And so now for the crypto skeptics or the no-coiners like myself, the next big one to watch is Tether. That's the biggest stable coin. It's the biggest source of liquidity in that market. Should I stop? Because I'm going to...
Carry on. You're literally answering my next question.
Well, see, that, so. The liquidity thing is really important, right? Because you can have... whatever Shiba Inu coin or Dogecoin, and it can be in your wallet in an exchange for $10,000, but your ability to withdraw that $10,000 is limited to what's the actual sort of cash circulating in the system. And stable coins are supposed to essentially be that cash and liquidity. The problem with stable coins, in particular Tether, which is this monstrously dodgy firm created by a CEO who's not been cited for 2 years, also founded by this guy Brock Pierce, who's a ex-business partner of Steve Bannon and involved in a really gross Hollywood scandal back in the 90s. And he's also one of the guys that's doing all the Puerto Rico and El Salvador crypto stuff. You just got to Google it. He's one of the creepiest dudes in this space. Well, they claimed that $80 billion was backed by $80 billion in hard cash. And it's backed by about 2% hard cash. And then lots of it is also things like U.S. Treasury bonds. And Tether is the fifth largest holder of corporate debt, so corporate paper that corporations trade between each other as sort of like promissory notes. And when Tether starts to go belly up, what that does to the real economy – we don't really know yet. It could be incredibly, this could be terribly bad, but there's nothing fundamentally of value underwriting that $80 billion in Tether.
And so will Tether go, and are we kind of on that like cusp of the death of crypto? Or?
Well, we've been, in 2018, I think it was, it went from 20,000 to 6,000. I mean, I think we've just been through this really ridiculous moment where, NFTs and celebs have been doing their thing and really trying to sort of like popularize this sort of, it's sort of like the clout economy meets the crypto economy. And, one of the big moments here were all the Super Bowl commercials with Matt Damon and, my God, Larry David, that one really hurt me. And Spike Lee, that was another insane one. But, They've been trying to squeeze that last little bit of like getting more people into the Ponzi scheme, if you will, right? That's how you keep a Ponzi scheme going, get more people in, and this is a lot of people have lost their shirts, and this is going to really dry up the reserves of just normal punters who can get in and have a go here. And in New Zealand, for example, BitPrime, which was a New Zealand exchange, they've basically shut shop and they're on hiatus or whatever. This is sort of like common thing. So a lot of people have been burned in these ways. Now, there are, big interests that have taken big bets in crypto, and maybe there are ways to rally. One of the things that crypto has been, quote, air quote, good at is like figuring out little algorithmic sort of financial tricks So, I mean, maybe there are ways of priming and minting and printing coins in ways that maybe shore up Ethereum. There's a lot of interest in Ethereum because a lot of tech companies are built on the Ethereum blockchain. There's a lot of, the big two, Ethereum and Bitcoin. So who knows? But going forward, there's no inherent value in any of this stuff. The people that tell you blockchain, forget about the NFTs or the cryptocurrencies, blockchain's this next great tech, it's not true. The actual use cases for blockchain are far and few between. Much existing tech does what some of this stuff already does. So we should be in a kind of terminal decline here, if all things going well, all things going rational. But, you know, financial markets are crazy.
Yep. Yeah. And so my final question for you briefly is, I've seen both some cryptocurrency enthusiasts and just finance guys more generally have actually started calling for crypto regulation. Do you think that is either worthwhile or even possible?
So I think the longstanding impact of like crypto and blockchain is as a sort of like metaphor, because what is crypto? It's the notion that you are this one superhuman, liberated techno subject navigating the modern life and the modern economy through blockchain and encryption. And that's where they claim that if we live in a metaverse or some such sort of, you know, new digital economy, the blockchain is going to be the thing undergirding it all. And that's not true. I mean, if you look at Meta, i.e. Facebook Meta, like that's going to be an enclosed, you know, Facebook-run economy. But they'll probably, you know, have aspects of it that are blockchain-ish or that appeal to some of these traditional notions of the blockchain. So it may exist as a sort of like ideal. But in practice, no, that tech will not exist. What was the question again?
just should it be regulated?
Oh, should
or
the regulated?
Could it be
the regulation thing? Okay, and now this is interesting because central banks, again, central banks are like the thing that crypto people hate the most. This was the whole point, was to get away from central banks and to be free, liberated, and there was a lot of sort of far right, libertarian, anti-Semitic conspiracy stuff about central banks inherent in crypto culture. So the notion that they would then run back to the central banks for some sort of regulation is ludicrous. I mean, there are, you know, different crypto exchanges and some stable coins that try to adhere more or less or closer to some manner of regulation than what is the majority of that space. So could it be that in the collapse, some people emerge that would be a sort of like industry standards for a tech that is not really required? I mean, maybe in theory, but I can't see the majority of this space as it exists to be unregulated. Mm. That's the whole sort of purpose. The same way that when Facebook wanted to launch its own currency, Libra, it was, you know, trying to create a problem so big that no regulators, no democracies could ever get their hands around this. So I'm sure there are some people that believe that earnestly, but it's really antithetical to what this thing is. And that's not why the majority of people are in it. So I'm going to go with a no.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on, Olivier. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks, man.
Excellent. That was Dr. Olivier Dutel talking about the cryptocurrency market collapse that's been plaguing crypto markets for the last week. Right now, you have Jang with All My Friends Are Cops here on R1 News. You're listening to R1 News here on Radio 1, and that was Jang with All My Friends Are Cops. I'm joined in the studio now by critic Te Arohi editor Fox Mayer to talk about this week's issue, the music issue of critic Te Arohi. Kia ora, Fox.
Hi, good morning.
How are you today?
I'm good. You know, I just heard the most interesting thing about cryptocurrency and liquidity and centralized banking, and I really... No, just let's talk about Taylor Swift.
Yeah, sweet. So my first question is on your editorial about Taylor Swift. Was there something in particular that triggered you to write this, or was it just a general thought that's been in the back of your mind?
Yeah, it was more general. I'd been thinking about it sort of all summer, and, you know, my girlfriend was talking about Taylor Swift a lot, and I was just realizing why I had... I'm wondering why I had these suddenly very negative reactions to an artist that I don't have any problems with when I think about it critically. Like, I have no problems with Miley Cyrus or Lady Gaga, so what did I have against Taylor Swift? And I still don't really know where that's coming from. I'm sure there's, like, a bit of just wanting to be against the grain and edgy, and I'm sure there's some internalized misogyny about the whole thing. But it's all in the editorial if you want to read it.
And so in your editorial as well, you said that you frothed You Belong With Me, which is the past tense was the thing I picked up on there. Has that song fallen from grace for you? Is there another song that's usurped it?
Still love it. I think it's still my favorite. I was just saying, like, I don't understand why I hated it past tense when at the same time I frothed this song. Still froth currently.
Yeah.
You Belong With Me, it still belongs on my playlist.
Do you have another Taylor Swift song? Or just,
that's definitely the number
That's
one
the number one?
Yeah.
Okay, and so music issue as well. Mm. Lots of good pieces in there. What are your thoughts on the Dunedin music scene?
Dunedin music scene, I mean, Dunedin is a musical city. Pavement was influenced by Dunedin sound, which I think is a testament to itself. Dunedin music scene is why people come here, and it's what keeps the city alive. And I think that as gig venues have been shutting down across the city, we're at risk of losing this piece of our culture that I think is extremely important as a touchstone. And, you know, the longer we go without having these student bars that people can play in and these gig venues across town, the further away from that sound we get until we can't really hear it anymore. And if we can't hear it, we can't remember how to keep that music playing for the next generation.
Do you want the council or the university? Who should step in there, do you think?
Well, I think everybody should step in there, because at the end of the day, it's not like a legislation thing. It's a question of, like, do you want good music in the city you live in or not?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, no matter who you are, right? Like, I'm sure there's more complicated politics in it when you really get down to it, but I think everybody should have a vested interest in protecting our music scene, because it's, like, one of the coolest things about living in Dunedin.
And so protecting it and putting in your own effort, is that going to gigs, basically?
Yeah, it's going
make
to gigs.
Make it big, make the market?
Absolutely. It's creating a demand, and then it's allowing the supply to be demanded and consumed. You know, if you've got friends or mates that are in bands, you go to their gigs, you help promote them, because at the end of the day, it's really fun, you know? And if somebody can make money by putting on a great gig, power to them. You know, you should support that any way you can.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on the show, Fox. Pleasure as always.
Thank you.
That was critic Te Arohi, Fox Mayer, talking about the music issue of Critic this week. That has been R1 News here on Radio 1 Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi 91 FM. I'm Quinton Jane, and I'm leaving you in the capable hands of Parabola West with No One Can Get Me here on The One.
This was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more at r1.co.nz or wherever quality content is found.